Welcome to Sensor Noise, a podcast about photography. I'm Andrew, joined as always. Okay, I tried to do that from memory and I like fell down.
You got it. Except for my name.
The problem is you were talking about having Aaron on. So in my brain, I was like, "Oh, Aaron, podcast, the guy I do podcast with."
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Joined as always by Arthur. Arthur, hello. You've been feeling under the weather, but you're feeling a little bit better. We've both been feeling under the weather. It's been last time we recorded, I was sick, but we didn't know what with. Turned out COVID, which I don't recommend.
I certainly don't recommend getting the.
If you do get COVID,
they call it the novel coronavirus, but I don't know about that at this point.
If you do get it, get the Paxlovid. It does make everything taste awful for like 5 days, but it also helps greatly in other areas. This week, we're going to talk about bags, but first, it is time to do the news. Big Nikon news this week. Nikon has announced new firmware for the Z9. Are you excited?
I don't know. I installed it, obviously, immediately.
You installed it, and the first thing, the thing that you pointed out was that it gives you different shutter noises now.
Yeah,
including one that's like a classic DSLR noise.
Yeah. So I've got that, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah. So I got that going for me.
I don't use the features that this improved. Like, yes, this is all for portraits and sports and stuff, which are things that I don't really do that often.
Yeah, expanded functions for sports photography and enhanced portrait functions.
Now, if they had released this last fall when I was doing sports, that would have been nice, but it's a little late.
A rich tone portrait picture control suitable for creating base images in situations that require retouching. I don't know. Is that a thing? That sounds like doing editing in the camera, which most people don't bother to do. So I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm really not sure who this is for.
Yeah.
Although interestingly, you see this, it has convenience has been increased with the ability to use the continuous LED light of the Profoto A10 as the AF illuminator. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty nice.
Yeah. Well, as we know, Profotos are the only flashes that you should use. So
right.
There's
no other brands. No one's ever heard of it.
That's right.
Though this is like, nice, though. There is actually a nice feature in their app, finally, which they added a feature to SnapBridge, which is something they haven't done in, 20 years at this point?
SnapBridge still on the old iOS 6, like,
skeuomorphic design. you can set up... it looks like you can set up some of the camera parameters in SnapBridge and then like upload them to the camera.
Interesting.
And apparently that works with the ZF, Z5, ZFC, Z50, and Z30.
Yeah.
Which is pretty nice.
Which they might as well put like, that's for noobs. The camera's for noobs, basically. Cause it's called easy shooting setup, and it can be used by tapping easy shooting setup in the SnapBridge camera tab, selecting a main subject or situation and deciding output parameters, such as having a soft out of focus background or motion blur.
Right.
So yeah, the idea is that if you don't know how to do that, I guess you can just do it in the app. But that's fine. I do think it's funny that like it tops out at the Z, like at the ZF, you know,
you could argue that the cameras are software defined. They could just add an easy mode to the camera and not require the app at all.
Yes. Right?
Like what is the app doing here?
That's correct.
It's not doing anything. Although what I'm reading here though, that the portrait features that we mentioned are from the ZF, from your camera, actually.
Oh,
so the ZF has those already.
Okay.
And now the Z,
they're probably buried them. Like seven menus.
Yeah, I'm sure they are.
This is the other problem with software defined cameras is like, I don't know how to change anything.
Yeah.
Like, it took me forever to figure out how to turn on the rule of thirds grid, you know?
Right. Oh, this is actually, there is one thing that's actually useful. Manual focusing is now possible with maximum aperture live view in manual mode. So you can have the real preview, like the maximum aperture preview, and still do manual focus, and it won't adjust the aperture down.
Nice.
That's actually good.
a feature that film SLRs have had for literally ever.
Well, if you want to get technical, sure.
Yeah. No, the big news this week was, of course, that Nikon acquired Red Digital Cinema.
That's right.
I guess is sort of a way for them to do an end run around having to license Red's patents mainly, but also,
yeah,
Nikon wasn't really in the cinema camera market, and now they most certainly are. So that'll be curious.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. Like, let's be honest, Red's entire business model is like suing people for trying to use raw compression. Yes.
That's
and then correct. Like licensing patents. That's Red's actual business. And it seems like with the legal battle that Nikon and Red had, Nikon decided that it would be easier in the long run to just buy them, and probably cheaper.
Yeah.
So I
honestly
kind of
respect it, because it's like, you know what? Fine.
Yeah, right.
now you can't cause us any more trouble, because we'll literally just fire all the people that have been annoying us. And yeah.
Yeah. Like, will Nikon stop doing that crap now? Or will Red stop doing that stuff?
Yeah.
Hopefully. I don't think that Nikon is a company that's drawn to doing litigation as a standard operating procedure.
Certainly not to the extent that Red has been.
Yeah. So I don't know. I don't think that they'll continue doing that. At least I hope not.
Yeah. But digital cinema does seem like an interesting market for them to enter. You know,
well, I mean, they were trying to do it with the Z9. You gotta remember that, like, in the early 2000s, like the pre-iPhone days, a lot of, I guess, I don't know how much this extended into movies, but I know in TV production, a lot of people used Nikon DSLRs because they were cheap. You could adapt basically any lens to them because they're F mount. Right. And so, like, I could spend $600 on a Nikon SLR that takes pretty good 1080p video. Mm-hmm. And if I completely destroy it, I don't care.
Right.
So, you know, that was a good thing. And that kind of, they kind of stopped doing that. Sony kind of took over that market.
Sony took over that market in a big way.
So maybe they want to go back there. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. It'll be interesting to see. Also, I'm just, you know, there's got to be lots of people who are, because there's lots of people who are weird fans of Red.
Yeah.
And they have got to be having a bit of an identity crisis that they're now Nikon users.
I don't know why they're.
I enjoy that.
Like, okay, MKBHD uses,
like,
Red.
Crying and pounding the table kind of thing.
Yeah, you know? I don't understand.
Because, there's like MKBHD and Linus Tech Tips who, like, buy the newest Red camera as soon as it comes out, regardless of how ridiculous it is, you know?
But they're not doing it as Red fanboys, I don't think. I think they're doing it because...
Well, they kind of are.
But they're also bought into the system.
Okay, so I Googled Red, and that was a mistake, because it's just showing me the color Red. Oh, here we go. Red Digital Cinema. Because I was going to say, like, so they've got, the V Raptor X, world's first large format global shutter.
I did see that. They've got global shutter now, which I think is probably more useful in a cinema camera than in a stills camera.
Yep.
I don't know.
And it does 120 frame per second 8K. So there you go.
Right.
Yeah. Anyway, I don't know anything about video cameras, and I don't intend to learn.
Here's the
thing,
which
is unfortunate.
Like a Porsche, they make all the money on the extras.
Oh, well, right. Because for Red cameras, you have to use like their storage devices, which are proprietary. Yeah.
Which are weirdly like military themed. They look kind of like gun magazines.
Oh, that's right. Because they call them Red magazines, don't they?
Yeah. Yeah. But not even that. Like, if you buy a Red camera, all you get for your $44,995 for that V Raptor XL
Which is a steal, I think we can agree.
All you get is the sensor. You get nothing else. It doesn't have a battery. It doesn't have a video monitor. No viewfinder. Nothing.
Yeah.
It's just a sensor. You make all your money on the other crap. Like here, they sell a top handle. Would you care to guess what a top handle for a Red V Raptor XL costs?
Oh, it's got to be like $1,000 at least.
It is $1,698.
Okay. So,
and this is a piece of plastic that screws into the top of the camera to allow you to carry it.
Yeah, but it's a very, bespoke piece of plastic, I guess.
Right. It has wood.
Okay, their batteries are $275.
That's
right. I'll never complain about Nikon battery prices again.
This is the cinema camera market. Like, this is just how it is.
Yeah, right. Well,
they're not
because if you're filming something with this, you either are working for like a big Hollywood studio or something at least adjacent enough to that they will have lots of money. You know? So
it does seem like with this V-Raptor XL, they have given up on their Red Mags, though.
Interesting.
They use a CF Express.
Well, see, honestly, that's probably easier for them. I would imagine. Now. Speaking of video cameras, for a while you were on the hunt for like the best quality webcam that you get. And you did end up with one that I think you generally like.
Yeah, I do actually like it quite a bit. I have the Insta360 Link.
Yeah.
It's great.
Which is 4K.
Quality is great.
But Logitech has come out with a Micro Four Thirds streaming camera called the Mevo Core.
Right.
And yeah, this is basically just a little box with a sensor in it that has a Micro Four Thirds mount. It's $1,000, which seems like a little much for this, but I guess that's the price of like streaming. I think there's like a gamer tax included in this kind of thing.
I think it's still cheaper though than like buying a Sony camera.
This is true.
And using it as your webcam, right? I think it's still cheaper than that.
Just about, yeah. I mean, you don't obviously get a lens with this. You do have to buy some sort of Micro Four Thirds lens to go.
Yeah, but those are
but
cheap and easily available.
Those are cheap, widely supported as well. Yeah. This is kind of interesting. Yeah. I think
apparently this line of stuff from Logitech has existed for a while, and I've just never heard of it.
Yeah, they didn't do a good job advertising it. They used to have, like, these Mevo cameras that were just, like, fixed lens streaming cameras. I don't know, they weren't very good. This is actually, I think, reasonably good. It includes interchangeable lenses and an HDMI port that can be plugged into a computer or an external recorder. Right. Also includes a 3.5mm audio input and two USB-C ports, so you can have it go like HDMI directly into a capture card, or you can plug it in as a USB-C webcam, yada yada.
Yeah.
So this is designed to sort of, I guess, bootstrap your streaming career. Although for $1,000, I don't know if you'll be bootstrapping that much. But
I want to know if it actually behaves like a webcam, because for a while I was using my old D750 as my webcam. Mm-hmm. And the biggest thing that bothered me about that was that you had to turn it on and off. Right?
Yeah.
It doesn't, like, a webcam sits idle until you start pulling a feed from it, and then it turns on. The Insta360 that I have does the same thing. It actually, like, it's a little gimbal, so it kind of like folds itself down, so it's not looking at you.
Right.
But like, does this thing, when you're not pulling a feed off of it, does it power down and then wait for you to do something or not?
Yeah, this has a software program for it, so I have to imagine that it
has
Logitech, options
the
for
best at software.
Yeah, well, right, because you're gonna install Options Plus for your mouse.
Yeah,
You gotta install Logitech G for your headset.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. You might have to
make sure that you don't also need Options, right? Because Options
right
because
your stuff might
everything.
Not be supported by Options Plus.
Yeah.
And
you
then
might
you
need two
install...
dongles too, depending on what hardware you've got.
And then you got to install whatever this software is that this uses.
That's a nice thing. The Insta360 that I have does have software, but you don't have to use it. It'll work if you don't use it.
That's nice. Things should just act like webcams, but
I do wonder, I'm seeing in the bottom of this article a link to a Chinese camera that came out last year, which is the same thing, a Micro Four Thirds.
Yes, I saw that as camera. Well.
I wonder if Logitech is just like white labeling that thing.
Entirely possible, yeah.
Like theirs is thicker, so maybe they're adding stuff onto it, but it looks very similar.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be surprised, because it's not like Logitech has camera design expertise generally. God, no.
I think though, if this came out a year ago, I probably would have ordered one and would try it.
Yeah.
Like it is what I wanted at that point. Yeah, for sure.
I do think this makes, I don't know how much sense it makes, because it's a 4K camera, but I don't know how many streamers are streaming and then you can watch in 4K. It feels
you
like
can't,
that's still,
but it's not about that. They do it for cropping.
Yeah, well, that's true. But like, it feels like it's still a very much a bandwidth and resolution constrained sort of thing. So it's the same with like, yeah, you can have a 4K webcam hooked up to Zoom, but it's not really going to use.
Well, Zoom doesn't 4Ks. Even support it.
Right. Exactly. But, so
no, I think it's basically it gives you. It gives you more flexibility. Like if you got a Prime for this, now you can crop in, have higher image quality and still get a 1080p image out of it.
Yeah.
That's the use case. Mm-hmm. Plus I suspect at this point, it might actually be fairly difficult to get a 1080p only sensor.
That is probably true.
It might be hard now. So yeah, you might as well get a 4K.
Mm-hmm. This was a shock. Fuji, announced the Instax Mini 99, which is a successor to the Mini 90. This looks like a classic, like, you know, leather bound camera, although turned on its side, because all Instaxes are like designed for portrait shooting. And also, in contrast to what have been the previous Instax releases, which have been like hybrid cameras that have a digital sensor and then sort of print onto the Instax film, this is like a proper analog image path.
And it, unlike other Instax cameras, it has settings.
It has a brightness control dial, shooting modes, a vignette switch, three focus modes, and a color effect dial, because what they did is they put four LEDs inside of it.
Burning an Instagram filter into the image when you
pretty much. So what you do is you like take the picture, and in the instant after the shutter closes, it will very briefly flash the LEDs in a color of your choosing. Although it's not necessarily colors, it's more of aesthetics, because it's faded green, warm tone, light blue, soft magenta, sepia, and light leak.
It's clever. So I mean, it really, like the pictures that they show, it really does look like those, you know,
the light leak one looked like a light leak to me, which I found kind of astounding. Yeah. Well,
the colored ones,
although I guess that's not that hard. It's true. If you just have a light in there.
The colored ones look like the, you know, you go on Instagram and you go to the filters, but if you scroll all the way to the left to get to the ones that nobody uses that are like the classic ones, it does look like those.
Yeah. They're really leaning into like the aesthetic aspect of this,
which I think is their target audience for this thing.
Yeah. What I do like is that it has a bulb mode, and I don't know how you would use that because there's no way to connect a external flash to one of these.
I don't,
which is what you'd normally use with a bulb mode, but whatever.
I don't know.
This is somewhat rare for an Instax camera. You can turn the flash off.
Yeah, that's wild. That's a big feature for this thing.
Yeah.
And it has it's tripod mountable as well.
It's tripod mountable, yeah.
I don't know who's doing that, but
it's the typical Instax thing where like the viewfinder is in a weird place, the shutter button is in a weird place, the tripod mount screw is in a weird place, but it works. It does feature a rechargeable battery that can't be charged while it's in the camera.
You take it out and put it in a charger. Now that charger is USB-C. So, you know,
but you can't just like plug the camera in and charge it. You have to take the battery out, and it's not like I have an Instax Mini. It just uses like a AA, you know, this doesn't, because of course not. The reviews I saw of this said that it was good, but it's somewhat hampered by the fact that like Instax Mini is probably the worst of the Instax formats because it's just small. Like if they had made this Instax Square or even Instax Wide, it would be much better. And I say that having recently used my Instax Wide camera that I bought. I have a stack of 20 Instax Wide exposures that I'm holding on to. And my quick review is that Instax Wide is a terrific film.
Yeah.
It's the colors are much better than Polaroid, but it still has that like analog look and it still has pretty bad exposure latitude. So it still has that analog look, but man, is it fun to shoot the Instax Wides. They're really great. Fuji, please come out with an Instax Wide camera because the one that you're currently selling was designed like 10 years ago. Please, yeah. I'm begging of you.
Maybe they will. Who knows? Seems like they're ramping film back up again.
I'm curious.
I hope they keep doing it.
Yeah. Speaking of ramping film up, yet more stuff. This is a news heavy episode.
It is. Yeah. We got a lot of stuff going on.
Lomography also surprise dropped a brand new 110 camera. 110 being approximately 16 millimeter frame size. And there has not been a new 110 camera in a very long time, but Lomography announced one. It's called the Lomomatic 110. It's designed in the style of classic 110 spy cameras that were made by like Canon and Minolta, which is to say it's just like a little rectangle. This is
interesting. What it looks like. Do you remember those instant cameras from the early 2000s?
The Polaroid iZone.
Yeah, there you go. That's what it looks like.
Don't ask me why I'm able to pull that straight off the dome. I don't know. But
I had one. I used that. I used the shit out of that
thing. Yeah, no, it looks a lot like an iZone, except sort of more vintagey. This has a glass lens, surprisingly.
Hey, that's something.
By the way, the Instax Mini 99, of course, is a plastic lens.
Yeah,
of course. This has a glass lens. It does automatic exposure. It has two aperture settings, manual ISO settings, and it has its zone focus with four zones. And it's only about like $110, basically.
£110.
£110, yeah. So
And they've got one, two, three. They've got six film stocks for it.
Yes.
Color Tiger 110, so Lomochrome Purple.
So the camera in the Golden Gate, which is the plastic theme, is $99. The camera and flash in the plastic theme is $119. And then you can get a metal body camera with flash for $159.
Well, now looking at these, why would you get them? You got to get the plastic one.
Yeah, no, it looks a lot better because it's like a beige and orange. I do kind of like the look of the metal one, but yeah.
But also the metal one's going to be a lot heavier. If you're going for this tiny little camera, you got to get the plastic one.
Right. And then you can shoot 110 in it, which is,
Develops 110?
certain labs. You're probably going to have to ship it off, I would say. But yeah, because 110 is a cartridge format.
Right.
Sort of like not quite how APS was, but similar. And Lomography is also the only place that still makes 110 film, and they don't make a whole lot of it. You've got an ISO 200 color, you've got an ISO 100 black and white, and then you've got like the Lomochrome Purple, the Color 92, and the Lomochrome Metropolis like art films. So, yeah. It's interesting. 110 is interesting because it's very small, so it tends to be quite grainy. It doesn't resolve a lot of detail, but again, I watched a review of this, and it was interesting. And this would certainly be if you want a film camera that you can just like put in your pocket, this is certainly a candidate. It'll
fit just fine.
And it's gonna give you very interesting looking images, to be sure. So
yeah. It also has a multiple exposure mode, apparently.
Yeah.
And the flash module has a little slot that you can use to stick colored gels in.
Oh, I saw that. Yes.
That's pretty clever.
I don't know how well the flash actually works on this, but
how well does the flash work? Like all these tiny flashes don't really do that much.
Right. Exactly. But
it's probably enough to add a little color cast to whatever you're taking.
Yeah, that's probably it. But this is interesting. Yeah. I don't know. Kind of a surprise. Does count as a new film camera, so I have to, you know.
It does, yeah.
We do have to hand it to them.
Now, if $100 is too much for you, they do have another 110 camera.
Oh, like the little Diana 110.
The Diana Baby 110.
Yeah.
For $34.90, you can get that.
That is certainly a camera that you can purchase.
if the $100 is too much for you.
I will say, so they, I think that Lomography is, has the, it's Lomography that has the Holga? No, Holga's, so there's a camera called the Holga, which takes 120 film, and they're like $60, because they're like, they're basically plastic toy cameras.
Right.
From Hong Kong. But I know folks who take great images on them. It's kind of wild, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know. Give it a shot, I guess. There's a Holga 120 panoramic. All right, now they have my attention. Also, more details about the Pentax, the new Pentax film camera. It'll be a half-frame model with zone focusing.
Cool.
Which is interesting.
Doing this. They keep having more news and still not selling.
Yeah. I think... The thing is, I'm unfortunately not that interested in a half frame camera, but sure. I think that they are seeing the popularity of these sort of the reusable disposables like the Kodak Ektar H35.
Yeah.
And things like that, which we'll get into later, falling in love with disposable cameras as a topic. They're sort of making like a proper camera for that, you know.
Right.
Which would be interesting. And then finally, to round out the news, Lens Rentals has now established a monopoly hold on the lens rental market.
Yeah.
More or less.
It's a monopoly. They've got everything now.
They purchased, quote, select assets from Barrow Lenses. I guess Barrow Lenses was owned by Shutterfly?
That is correct. They were owned by Shutterfly.
And Shutterfly has basically unloaded it onto lensrentals.com. I've used lensrentals.com. It's fine.
I've used Barrow Lenses because they have a pickup location. Well, they had a pickup location.
Not
in
anymore.
Waltham. Well, they had one in Waltham where I used to live, and then they had one in San Carlos where I live now. So I would just, like, you didn't have to order it. I could just go pick stuff up
there. Okay. It does say that they are keeping the San Carlos location open.
Okay, well, that's handy, I guess.
Yeah. So, good for you, I suppose.
They also own Lens Pro to Go. They own them as well, which is the other one.
Right, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, they own all of them.
Lens
Pro to Go.
Yeah. I don't know if it's good that there's like one big company that controls the... I mean, frankly, what I've been doing lately is renting lenses from the local camera stores because it's a lot more convenient.
Well,
But if they also local don't,
camera stores do rentals. That's way better.
Yes, but they also don't have nearly as much stuff as lensrentals.com does, right. You know.
I mean, I wonder, like, this is a tough business to be in, I think. It shrinks every year. Like, the amount of people renting this gear shrinks.
Yeah, and like lensrentals.com, to their credit, has lenses that I could rent that fit on my Pentax 645N.
Oh, they've got everything. Like,
yeah,
they got everything.
It's kind of wild. I was surprised.
I've used them before I went back to Barrow Lenses because I could pick it up. But like their customer service is unbelievably good. Mm. I've had instances where I had a broken lens, and I was on vacation and they overnighted me a new one to the hotel I was at. Like their customer service is great.
Yeah.
It's not great that there's only one.
Yeah. But I do recommend lens rental, like, as a general practice
Trying
a lens that you think you might like. Cause
yeah.
I have eliminated some lenses from contention that way, and also gotten myself into trouble that way.
I mean, frankly, one of the nice things is doing the rentals stops you from just buying a lens because you think you need it for one thing.
Right.
You can just rent it and then you don't
you
have
can just
to buy
rent it, and then you can use it and be like, well, actually, I think was it lensrentals.com that I rented the Ricoh GR3X from? I think it was.
Probably.
And yeah, so I was like, I think I might like this camera, and I rented it, and I was like, yeah, it's okay, and sent it back.
Yeah.
And I was out, you know, like $100 rather than $1,000. So,
right.
Yeah. Another thing that people are doing to try cameras, is getting into disposable cameras. It's an article here in the Washington Post entitled "Falling in Love Again with Disposable Cameras." Gen Z and others find a nostalgic, if fuzzy, thrill in taking pictures and then waiting days to see the results. If I was really thinking, I would have had disposable camera correspondent Dave, the old camera guy on here. But, you know, I certainly have seen this, you know, one of the camera stores here, like for Christmas, had an absolute ton of disposable cameras like in stock,
right,
that they went through pretty quickly. And you have a shocking amount of choices these days in the disposable camera world.
Yeah,
you
can know. Get, it's weird.
You can get a Fuji QuickSnap, and then there's like two different color Kodak disposable cameras you can get.
Yep.
There's also you can get a Kodak black and white disposable that has Tri-X in it, which is kind of neat. And then you can also get like Ilford disposables with Ilford films in them. So yeah,
and you can still get those, the underwater ones as well.
You can also get the, which, you know, when it comes to using that or buying like a special underwater digital camera, like
I'd buy the cheap.
It's gonna be doing just fine. So
we were at a wedding last weekend, and, the flower girls were all young. They were like under 6 years old, and we bought them each disposable cameras for the wedding, because it was a no kids wedding except for the flower girls, so they didn't really have that much to do. So we bought them disposable cameras for the reception. They loved it. They were like zooming around taking pictures of everything. They were little paparazzis.
I think there's something about the, you know, you click and the flash goes off, and then you have to wind it and it goes click, 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 you know, because I bought my half brother one for Christmas, and he was fascinated by it as well.
We didn't even really have to explain it to them. They figured it out on their own, which is kind of astounding.
Yeah. Yeah. So they've got the you know, if you're thinking, this is my recommendation, if you're thinking about getting a disposable camera, you've got the Kodak Fun Saver, which is fine. But I would get the Kodak Power Flash, because that has ISO 800 film.
Right.
And it's the only camera in which that and format in which that particular film is available.
Yep.
So you try unique film stuff. Of course, the Kodak Professional Tri-X 400 single use would be interesting as well. Black and white. Who doesn't love black and white? So. But, you know, it seems as well that compact cameras of all sorts are making a comeback. It turns out the release of the Fuji X106 has also caused a rise in demand.
Massive supply problem,
but has also been it sort of caused another increased demand for the Ricoh GR3 series.
Yeah.
That in fact, a couple weeks ago, Ricoh announced that it is no longer accepting new orders for those cameras. because they are unable to keep up with production. Now, were they producing like maybe five a week? I don't know, but you know, clearly they
probably
clearly they got to ramp up demand a little bit. So it's curious. And then at the same time, do you know what the most searched for item of retro tech was last year?
Oh, I do. I have no idea.
It was the Nikon Coolpix S6900.
who's buying a Coolpix?
Apparently, Gen Z loves the old point and shoots.
You know, fair enough.
For the aesthetic. And I can attest to this because I was at World of Photography, one of the local used camera stores here, on Saturday. And I was, you know, hanging around, loitering, basically, as I do. and someone walked in, you know, and they're like, hey, how can we help you? And they immediately asked for the digital point and shoots, which like they don't have very many of because those were all pretty terrible cameras and people just threw them out rather than like holding onto them or selling them.
Nobody kept them.
Like they're kind of in high demand now, I guess, for the aesthetic of them. I think you and I sort of struggle to understand this because we lived through that era, and it's like, why would you want, you know?
So like, if I want a camera through that era, but I also have like my wife's cousins that live here have two kids that are like end of high school, beginning of college age. Mm-hmm. And so I've come to understand like why they want this.
That's interesting. So what's the theory? Because I don't get it.
Those kids are way less attached to their social media than I think we were. Like they weren't Facebook people.
Well, that's because when we began with social media, it hadn't been ruined yet.
Yeah, but they're way more cynical about it, and I think they understand that it's all crap. They get that. And so what I notice is,
imagine knowing that from the start and not finding that out the hard way.
God, I know, right? What I notice with them, like they're on their phones all the time, obviously, because they're kids, but they're not like taking pictures of everything they do and posting it on Instagram like millennials do.
Yeah.
They're taking weird, like they call them 0.5s, but they're using the like wide angle lens and they're taking weird photos of their friends with the wide angle lens on their phone.
Right.
That's what they're doing. And they don't post them anywhere.
Do you think it's just the saturation of like the fact that you can take a perfect photo like at any time means that it's not that interesting?
No, I think they like that. They like the portability of them and they like that it doesn't require them to be on their phone.
Well, but I mean, like the reason that folks are using like these old digital point and shoots is because like your iPhone, like I can capture, you know, a perfectly crystal clear image at any point. And so that becomes routine and boring. And so you want something different, basically.
That might be part of it. But I think some of it is, at least from what I can tell,
just to put the phone down.
They don't want to. They just don't want to use their phones all the time.
I respect that and wish that I could in any way.
If you think about it now, like, I don't know, when I was in college and like leaving college, you could still do school without a phone.
That's true.
Like you could. And now the phone is school. The phone is your job. The phone is everything. And
because
they just want to not have to use their phone to remember their things that they were doing.
Yeah. Well, I remember, you know, I got my first smartphone after my senior year of high school.
Yeah.
Like with the intention of taking it to college, but it was still pretty uncommon at that time. And also like the phones were not doing nearly as much as they do these days. And they weren't as good for a lot of stuff, you know,
when it wasn't required.
Yeah.
Like the kids in high school now, you have to have a phone.
Yeah.
That you can't.
Which is wild because we would get yelled at for having.
I know.
You know.
And they still do, but like then you have to have it so you can talk to your group chat about the presentation that nobody wants to do.
Right.
I mean,
yeah.
I think that's most of it. It's just like they're
constantly.
They don't want it. They don't want to have to be on their phone all the time.
They didn't have the option to log off that we do.
Yeah. You know, and we're losing it every day, but
yeah.
At least in high school, I could have put my phone down and no one would have bothered me, but you can do that now.
I admit that I am tempted occasionally by like some of these like dumb phones or like these like anti-smartphone type things.
Yeah.
I've looked into them seriously before, but I don't know. I think I'm too, I don't know. I'm worried that like if I leave my phone behind, I'll miss something important, I guess.
So I've tried this, not with the dumb phones, but with an Apple Watch. Like I have a cellular Apple Watch.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
the thing I wanted to do was go to Disneyland and leave my phone in the hotel room. That's what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
You can't.
You can't.
You straight up can't do that because there's no like app on your watch to get your ticket. And you need your ticket to get into the park. And then you need the app to make any dining reservations. You need the app to get on any of the rides. Like you,
yeah,
you can't not have your phone.
And, well, and they do, you know, they don't print the Disney dollars anymore, so you can't pay for anything.
Well, you can do Apple Pay. They do take Apple Pay now. But it's just, it's like the in a place like Disney World or Disneyland where you think everything will be taken care of for you, you know, because it's Disney World is like the simulation of being ultra rich. Mm-hmm. You still need your phone all the time.
Yeah.
To be able to do anything.
Right.
And I think, you know, there is an environment like that. It'd be really nice to have something that's just a camera to carry around.
Right.
I don't need my phone. I can just carry this little camera around, take pictures and remember these things.
Yeah.
And also, I think for me, phones are boring now.
That's true.
Like,
yeah,
phones are really like, dumb and boring.
It's like what the big thing for the iPhone 15 was that it has USB-C now, which is not
which is nice, an but also like,
necessarily it's just a difference, you know. Yeah.
Yeah, but this Coolpix X6900 has a kickstand and a selfie mode
and
flippy screen, like,
and it comes in pink, an actual color.
Yeah.
Technology is not colorful anymore either, and that's also a problem.
I think we also forget that like we grew up in such a weird age of tech. Everything was super weird all the time.
Do you remember texting phones?
Yeah,
those were weird, great
slidey things.
I had an LG Voyager.
Or even just the iPod. Every year the new iPod looked weird.
Oh god.
Right?
Especially the iPod Nano. Where they're, you know, it was very tall and thin, and then one year they're like, it's stout now.
Yeah, right. Like, I don't know, the phone, now, like, if you grew up, if you're like my little brother who was, like, grew up in the late 2000s and is graduating high school this year, he doesn't, like, the phones have looked like the same thing for his entire life.
Right, yeah.
That's really boring.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's all boring now. Anyway, what were we talking about?
These cameras, like people wanting these old cameras it's just a rejection of that. And the same with the Fuji. I mean, part of the Fuji's draw
is
the film simulations, for sure. People really
like that. I also think that it's like a really high quality camera, but it's also compact and you don't need to because I noticed that, you know, there is a learning curve, or at least a perceived learning curve, for a lot of people with interchangeable lens cameras, you know? Yeah,
absolutely.
And it's like, oh, this is a camera I can just pick up, turn on, and point at stuff? Like, great. You know?
I don't even know if it's interchangeable lens. I think it's size. I think that just, like, literally the bigger the camera is, the more intimidated people are by it.
Right. Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's interchangeable or not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I have a Fuji. I'm not getting rid of it. And it's the one I carry around most of the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't think that's going to change.
Well, and I like my, you know, I obviously have the film cameras, you know, for that sort of purpose. Speaking of, we don't have this as a topic, but how was your, you shot film, yes?
Well, no, I didn't.
Oh, rip.
I brought my film stuff with me to Florida for this wedding. And then there was a photographer there, and I was like, huh, I can take a break for once. What if there were photos of me?
Interesting
That's
thought.
It's a crazy thought. So I ended up leaving all the stuff at the hotel for the wedding. Hmm. And I don't know. It was nice to not be on.
No, I get that. Honestly, you know, like use it when you will enjoy using it, you know?
Yeah.
Not when you feel obligated to use it.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. So we'll follow.
It was weird. I had to take the film out for the TSA so they didn't ruin it.
Oh yeah, of course.
And of course they were like, what's film?
Yeah. What is this? Yeah.
The guy at the front is like, make sure to take out any film you might have. Like he says that. I'm like, oh, right. You got to take your film out.
Like, wait, that applies to me now.
And I handed it to him. And they take it down to the end to have it manually inspected. And the person down there is like, he has no idea what it is.
Yes.
Like, this guy just said, I have to take the film out. And I come down here and you don't know.
I had this experience traveling last summer where, on some legs, like they didn't really care at all. Like one guy, like I'm like, yeah, here's my bag of film. And the guy looked at it and was like, oh, film, like looked in there and was like, yeah, okay. Then on the way back, they stopped and they took my backpack over to the, like the urine trouble inspection station kind of place. And they took each individual film canister out and popped each roll of film out and did their little swab thing on them, you know?
Yep.
And I had a lot of film and it took like a good 10 minutes because she was individually popping open each canister, pulling the film out, swabbing it with the goofy swab thing. And of course they put the thing in and it says it's fine. It's of course it's fine. It's film.
Every single time I have gone through the Fort Lauderdale International Airport, I have been swabbed.
Yeah.
Every single time I get swabbed. And they never, like, there's never anything. But in this case, it was
each time when I come here, I am swabbed.
This time it was my camera suitcase. Mm. And boy, it took them quite a while to pull literally every single thing out of it and swab it.
Yeah.
I was standing there for probably 25 minutes while they pulled every little thing out and swabbed it. Yeah. Just the worst.
Yeah. Speaking of camera suitcases.
Oh, yeah. Hashtag bag watch.
We're going to finally talk about bags and stuff. This is from a couple weeks ago now, but Wandered, because it's one of those no vowels. they have released a new transit travel line.
Yeah.
Which these I guess is meant for, rather than like your backpacking kind of travel, this is more meant for urban travel, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, it seems like it's for, you know, trains and...
they got a carry-on roller bag now, which is nice. It offers a hidden AirTag pocket. Interesting.
The carry-on roller is interesting. I may get one of these just separately because my carry-on roller is not very good.
Yeah. I'm looking here at the transit travel backpack, which is 45 liters, but Wandered, I wanted to talk about specifically, well, we've had to discuss about bags on our topic list for a long time now, because photo bags are a topic of great debate.
Bags is an evergreen topic. You can always talk about bags.
Yeah. You introduced me to the Wandered family of products.
I did.
And specifically the Provoke backpack, which is spelled P-R-V-K-E, and so I like to call it the Privkey.
Privkey, that's right.
Which is a very good, that's the bag that I tend to use when traveling, because it has the little camera cube in there, but it also has a compartment big enough for other stuff, you know?
If you want. And it's worth noting that it's configurable. So like
that is true.
By default, it comes with a camera cube that takes up half of the bag, but you can take that out and put in one that takes up the whole bag if you want.
Yeah. But I use it as like a split bag because I like to put, you know, other stuff in the other compartment, like a battery charger kind of thing and all that.
Me too.
And that works. It's a really great bag. It's made of extremely durable materials. It's waterproof.
It's fairly stiff, but not in the way that like a Peak Design bag is.
Yeah.
It like holds its shape. And actually, if it's loaded, even if it's not loaded that much, it stands up on its own, which is very clever.
That's true. Also has a water bottle pocket that actually like holds the water bottle in such a way that it doesn't just fall out, which is nice.
And critically, it doesn't, when you put the water bottle in, it doesn't like compress the side of the bag. It extends out from the side of the bag.
Yes.
So it doesn't take up space use it, which is nice.
It's a great bag, but, and I think this may be news to you, it is not the bag that I use the most often.
Oh, really?
No.
What do you
The use? Bag that I use the most often when I'm just tooling around here locally is the Think Tank Streetwalker Pro version 2. The
Think Tank, yes.
Because this bag does not have any compartments that aren't for camera stuff.
Exactly.
And this is a giant backpack that I can fit as many as five cameras into if I'm really going insane.
Yeah.
But this is also a camera that I can fit my Pentax 645N with its longest lens into and still have room for more lenses and cameras. And let me tell you, I load this thing up so it hurts my back sometimes.
Right.
But that's the point. It's big. It has lots of space. I can fit all the stuff in there. And yeah,
if you are unfamiliar with Think Tank makes like serious bags.
Yeah.
Like these
are a serious bag.
They don't look good. They are not flashy. These are like, you need to carry 8 cameras with you. We got
a bag. I guess it's kind of good that this isn't flashy because it doesn't read as like, this is a bag full of expensive camera equipment. Right. Instead, it reads as like, this is my JanSport, you know? But it is huge and has a lot of space and dividers for camera stuff.
Like they make a hiking backpack that's for cameras, the 50-liter hiking backpack that you can fit, I don't know, 8-9 cameras into if you really jam them in
there. For reference, this Think Tank Streetwalker is probably one of the only bags that you can get that will fit a Canon R3 plus the 400mm f2.8 lens.
Because
they have a picture of it in that camera. It takes up literally the entire compartment of the backpack, but it does fit in there. That is a huge lens.
I also appreciate, I think my favorite bag of theirs is the glass limo. Which is $275, but it will fit a Nikon Z9 with the 400mm prime attached to it.
Wow.
So it's just a bag and it holds just that. It's got a little cubby for your camera to sit in so that it doesn't get jostled around. Like,
right.
They make the serious bags.
You know, so this is what they have. Think Tank has a section of like what fits in this bag. And for the Streetwalker Pro version 2, it says holds 2 gripped DSLRs, 4-6 standard zoom lenses and a 10-inch tablet, 1 gripped DSLR, 5-7 standard zoom lenses and a 10-inch tablet, or 2 large mirrorless cameras, 4-6 lenses, a flash and a 10-inch tablet. And in my experience, I can fit my 645 camera in there, my F100 and another 35mm camera and about 3 other lenses plus the other magazine for my 645 camera. And then also like 12 rolls of film in various sizes. So it's a tank.
Yeah.
And I love it. And everyone always makes fun of me for my ridiculous backpack.
Well, guess what? You're a serious who's laughing
now. Yeah, exactly. You know, listen, what I was studying the blade, you know, all of this is to gloss over that, like the power player, it seems in the photo bag market is Peak Design.
Yeah. At least if you listen to YouTube, that's true.
Whose bags never really appealed to me to begin with because they almost seem too slick. They seem like form over function, which is why I've never really tried them.
Yeah,
I don't know. Is that a fair assessment?
To an extent. Okay. I used to be like my first big photo bag was the Peak Design Everyday, the 30 liter, you know, the one that everybody has.
Right.
And
why do they measure the stuff? I don't know how many 30 liters is.
Like, I don't know. All the bag companies do.
Is that 15 2-liter bottles? I don't know.
I guess it is.
Like, you can't fit them all in there. I don't know.
So if you're walking around San Francisco or San Jose, you're going to see hundreds of these because this is now the like standard tech guy backpack.
Standard issue. Yeah.
This is what every tech guy has now. Mm-hmm. I would say that if you, it says example camera carry, mirrorless camera body and lens plus 4 or 5 extra lenses. Bullshit. No, it's not. Mm-hmm.
you think that's optimistic?
DSLR camera body plus 2-3 extra lenses. No, you cannot. Fits a full frame DSLR plus 70-200 pro lens plus another lens. No, it doesn't.
No,
that's just not true. So like I used this with when I was doing DSLR with my D750. And you could fit the D750. I could fit my 35mm lens in there. And then I could fit maybe another lens or two. And that's assuming I don't want to carry anything else. because the other problem with the Peak Design bag is if you use the side, the exterior side pockets for a water bottle or like they suggest, a tripod,
yeah,
it encroaches on the interior space of the backpack. It compresses the sides in.
Yeah.
Additionally, putting anything like the flaps on the side have pockets in them, like for organizing stuff. So you put, you know, memory cards, batteries or whatever in there. That also encroaches on the space in the interior of the bag. So you lose like a ton of the space in there if you use any of the other organization stuff that it has.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I used to bring this to like Disney World and I would try to fit, like for walking around in the daytime, I would try to fit all of my camera stuff and a tripod for the fireworks and a water bottle. And that was a tight fit. That was really, really difficult. I think that if you are a Sony user, this is probably fine for you. And I say that because it like, they say that you can fit a DSLR body, like a full frame DSLR in there.
Yeah.
And you can, but you can't put it. How do I put this? You can't put it like horizontally. You have to put it vertically. So like you can't have it so that the grip is facing like your back. If you were wearing the backpack, it has to go facing the sky because it's not wide enough to accommodate the full size of the camera body. But if you were using a Sony body, especially the older ones that were smaller, that would fit just fine in there. And then sure, you can probably fit what they say. You can fit a mirrorless camera and 4 to 5 lenses. I think you could if you were using E-mount. If you're using anything else, if you're Canon, Nikon, even Fuji, no, you're not fitting that in there.
Yeah.
And also, I didn't find it that waterproof, like it says. That was another thing.
Yeah.
Water got in
there. It is interesting to compare, like, how this backpack looks in the images to one of the backpacks from Wandered. Or, or Think Tank. Like, and you can tell, like, a backpack that is designed to carry lots of camera gear and versus this, which like isn't really like it seems like the camera carrying capability of this is like not the primary design feature, you know?
Yeah,
because it's an everyday carry backpack and it's like, well, you can carry cameras in it, you know?
They designed it for a very specific use case, and if you're outside of that use case, it just is not going to work.
Which it's interesting to me because like I like Peak Design's other camera stuff.
Yeah,
like
their tripod is great.
I use their camera straps because I like them a lot.
You know, their camera straps, their anchor system is great. The capture clip thing that you can clip onto like a strap of a backpack and easily put your camera in there. That's
don't
great.
You use their case thing, their phone case that like clips on?
Oh yeah, stuff? their mobile line is great. Like because they have a bike mount for it, which is fantastic.
Yeah,
the tripod is really good.
God, the tripod's like, great.
All the rest of their stuff is great, but the backpack is just I don't know.
What's interesting is that I recently this week have seen a new challenger enter the backpack market, at least among people I know, and that's Nomadic. Are you familiar with Nomadic? I had not heard of it. I'm putting the link in here.
Most functional gear ever.
They have a camera pack. It's 35 liters. What I found astounding about this is simply the price. It's a $400 camera backpack.
Oh, okay. And, sure. That's fine.
Well, the Streetwalker Pro V2 that I have is you know, $230. I saw the price of this. I went, what?
Oh, you see, I see what the deal is. They have a Peter McKinnon collection.
Yes, that's what this is.
Yeah. Okay, I see.
For their
camera bags. I see.
Yeah, this is, I think, their flagship camera bag. It's a 35-liter backpack, and it's like one big old compartment like my Streetwalker that, you know, with customizable Velcro dividers that you can fit a lot of stuff in. But this is very expensive.
I mean, I'm sure it's fine.
I don't plan to try it given the cost. But
one part of this that I actually like that it says is that It has like the camera compartment and then a separate expandable compartment on the front for clothes. So actually is fairly functional for travel. Like you could bring all your camera stuff and also carry a couple of changes of clothes in the front, which is something that the Wander doesn't do quite as well.
This also does have a side access door, which I will admit my Streetwalker does not have any sort of side access. You have to take the whole thing off to get into it. You know,
interesting.
So it goes.
I mean, the more innovation we have in this space, the better, I think. Yeah. But the prices are getting ridiculous.
It's true. I guess I am sort of curious to buy, because like you said, the Wandered bags can be, you can swap out like the camera cubes for an expanded one.
Yeah.
And I had thought about trying that and then kind of didn't, but I'm sort of thinking if I should try that with my Wandered bag and see how that goes.
So when I'm bringing a bunch of cameras places, I don't want, like, if I'm flying somewhere, if I'm carrying more than like one or two lenses, I'm not going to put them in my backpack. I'm going to put them in a rolling case. And I have a Manfrotto rolling case. I don't know if they even make the one that I have anymore. I got it a while ago, but I can fit every piece of camera gear that I own in there. And it fits in the overhead bin just fine. So like for this wedding, I didn't need to use all my stuff, but I brought all my stuff just in case. And I put it in that roller and just carried it all with me instead of the backpack.
Yeah. Interesting.
But Think Tank has a nice roller as well. The Photo Airport International V3 is quite nice.
Oh.
It's the one I wanted to get, but it was very out of stock when I needed to get one, and it didn't know when it was coming back, so I ended up going with a different one.
Yeah.
Oh, here it is. No, I have the Manfrotto Pro Light Reloader Switch 55.
Oh, very nice. That's quite a name. actually,
like they've upgraded it. So now it has backpack straps on it as well. Ooh. Mine doesn't have that, but that would be kind of nice.
The piece of Wandered gear that I actually use probably the most often is the Rogue 9-liter sling, which is like your typical shoulder bag.
Oh yeah.
Camera shoulder bag. That's what I use if I'm only bringing like one, maybe two cameras. Cause that
I've got
convenient. And it's also made of the same stuff as their backpack. It's very nice. I have it in orange, which it's a very fetching orange. Eye-catching as well.
The all new D1 fanny pack. That's what I have in yellow actually.
Yeah.
And it's quite nice.
I would note with Wandered, they have a green color, but the green color is really more of a gray. It's not that green. I was a little disappointed that it wasn't as green as I was hoping. But the orange is a very nice orange. So if you want a backpack that's not, you know, like black or gray colored, they do offer that.
Shout out to the Australians who made me aware of Wandered. It seems like they're bigger there than they are here.
Yep. They've also got this, they have like a hip pack that you can like fold up and put inside another bag.
Yeah.
And it has like a cushioning compartment that you actually inflate yourself. And I put that in a suitcase for traveling and used it on my vacations last year. It's kind of neat. I like the Wandered stuff. I might look into more of their things. I think
I'm less backpack crazy than I used to be.
This is true.
I have a whole bin of backpacks.
You get old and your garage back starts to hurt and you're like, well.
Well, whenever one would come out, whenever there'd be a cool new one, I'd be like, oh, I'll get one of those.
Yeah,
sure. I have like four Tom Bin bags and I don't use any of them.
Right. I was definitely cycling through backpacks a lot in like college.
Oh,
and there was also a period of time where I was a Timbuktu sling bag user for a time until that hurt my shoulder, you know, and then I switched back to backpacks and then I was just like trying all the different backpacks. And like the thing is, I think for a non-photo backpack, like a backpack just to carry your laptop and stuff around, Tom Bin has pretty much solved that.
Yep. Pretty much.
That's Tom Bin, B-I-H-N. They pretty much solved that. Weird that they don't make any sort of photo or camera stuff at all, given that
I don't really understand that.
I don't know. That seems like a market they're missing out on, but whatever. But yeah,
especially because of where they're from.
Yeah.
They make all their bags in Seattle. Like, surely there's camera people there who want camera bags.
It's perplexing. Yeah. I don't understand it. But yeah, those are our bag opinions, I guess. Feel free to tell us that we're wrong, because I know that there are folks who really love the Peak design. And you know what? Good for you.
Good for you. Must be nice.
Good for you. Tell me something historical here.
All right. I wanted to talk about,
that's my segue.
Yeah. This is the camera history segment. I wanted to talk about the Foveon sensor a bit. Mm-hmm. So the way that traditional camera sensors work is not the way that you think that they work. Mm-hmm. You don't have one pixel, like when it says the camera is, 45 megapixels. Mm-hmm. There aren't actually 45 million pixel sensors in there.
Right.
It's complicated optics, physics stuff, but basically, like, there's a filter in front of the sensor. Each of the mm-hmm. pixels is only measuring one color, and usually
Bayer filter.
Yeah, Bayer filter is a typical pattern. Doesn't Fuji use a different pattern?
Does it? I don't know. Yeah.
In any case, there's a filter, and then
Fuji uses EXR color array.
Right.
The Fuji X-Trans, yes, it does.
Yeah, the X-Trans is the only one that's different. Everyone else uses a Bayer filter. But the effect is that since you don't have a color reading for each red, green, and blue at every pixel site, you're kind of guessing what the color would be based on the nearby ones. Mm-hmm. And you end up with noise at low light because it doesn't know. That's sort of the problem with these. And, you know, over the years, they've gotten better and better. And now we're at the point where it doesn't really matter anymore. But this company called Foveon, which was later bought by Sigma, had a different idea, which is, what if every pixel measured every color? You know, like how you'd think that it works.
Fascinating.
So the way that Foveon works is it's a stack, and the top layer is thin, it absorbs blue, the middle layer is green that absorbs green, and then the bottom layer is red. And I guess it, like, this works because as it goes down through the wafer, it naturally filters out and the red light ends up at the bottom. So that's sort of what it does.
The higher wavelengths get absorbed more quickly.
And what you end up with is a sensor where if it says, 20 megapixels, you actually have that many pixels.
20 megapixels of color resolution.
Yeah. And they're all, every pixel is reading each color. So Sigma launched a camera with this originally in 2002. There were a couple of others. Polaroid announced, Polaroid had one as well with a Foveon sensor in it. And now, I don't know, it's kind of dead. I think technically you can still buy Sigma with them.
You can still buy Sigma cameras. They are still making them with the sensor. Sigma is claimed to be working on
a new
camera. I don't know. Maybe we'll report on that at some point in the future. But yeah,
it's not even it's not a new camera. Supposedly they're working on a new full frame Foveon sensor.
Oh, that would be interesting. Yeah,
it's worth noting that I don't think any of the prior Foveon sensors have been full frame. They're all crop in one way or another.
Yeah, I note that the Sigma FP, which is their current full frame camera, mentions nothing about being Foveon.
Yeah, because it's not.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
The only camera you can currently get is the DP1 Quattro, which is a fixed lens 19mm camera that has the Foveon X3.
It
says equivalent to 39 megapixel high resolution,
which is true.
Right.
It's the same way that the Leica Leica that has the black and white cameras.
Yes. Yeah.
Where those sensors,
Leica and Pentax.
And now, Pentax,
which
both.
Is, yeah, which is where it's a black and white, and they do that by just taking the color filter out so that you get all black and white. Yeah.
And the cameras, like, you get higher resolution effective images out of those because you're not losing half of the data to interpolation.
Right.
Foveon was the same way.
Yeah.
It's interesting that we had this technology and kind of gave up on it, seemingly.
Yeah.
When this came out, it wasn't clear that CMOS sensors like what we have now were going to be the way forward. That wasn't like guaranteed at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But Foveon, I guess, just didn't get lucky, and more people were working on CMOS sensors.
Yeah, and I also think that CMOS sensors are just sort of like partly a reason for their success is that they're so similar to, microprocessor chips in terms of how you fabricate them.
Yeah, that helps
relatively
quite a bit
easy. Yeah, so you know, as portable electronics got popular and those shrunk, it became easier to make high resolution CMOS based photo sensors. So which, you know, it's the same too, because like you used to have CCDs, mm-hmm. which offered better quality than CMOS sensors as well, but like again, CMOS sensors just became cheaper and easier to make than a CCD.
At the time that this came out, you could have purchased cameras with all three types. They were all available at the time.
And it's like a CMOS just kind of won out because it's like cheaper and easier and good enough, generally speaking. So especially at the megapixel ranges that we're currently at, you know, like it's fine, I guess, you know, I don't know.
I think
you get perfectly clear photos with CMOS sensors. It would be interesting, you know, to try a Foveon camera and compare it, but.
Yeah. From what I've heard, like the ones that you can get still are not very good.
Yeah.
Like, well, especially because they've like these fixed lens so much ones. Better.
And, yeah.
They're just, they're not good anymore.
That's interesting. Yeah. It's sort of like the Lytro, that light field camera that we talked about. Yeah.
There's probably some patent crap in here too, because the idea of Foveon is patented by Foveon.
Right.
I don't know if you can actually like can someone else make a Foveon sensor like this? I don't know. Probably not yet.
Yeah.
Whereas CMOS is more of a technology that is like it's a transistor technology, not even a sensor technology.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure there were patents on it, but it seems like it was easy enough to either implement around those or whatever. So,
yeah, it was patented, but it seems like everyone just kind of gave up. It was patented in like the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
So people just gave up on that at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about, like, there was an alternate there were two alternate sensor types that we didn't end up using.
We could have lived in an alternate reality where we all had giant cameras with three CCDs in them, one for each color.
Yeah. I mean,
that was a thing for a time. You can look up the Minolta that did that. It's wild, but yeah.
That's still a thing in some cinema cameras, isn't it?
It is, yes. Yeah. Like for specialized applications, it is still better, you know, till you have a CCD in some cases. So, especially, but I think that's going to shrink, especially now that global shutter CMOS sensors are becoming less esoteric, I guess. So
We'll see what happens with those. We'll see if Red sues anyone who tries to use one in a cinema camera.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, thank you for listening to Sensor Noise. You can find us at sensornoise.com, on Instagram, and on Blue Sky. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend about it.